I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, happy Christmas, and welcome to your own personal Beatles. It's a Christmas bloody special. My name's Jack Belling.
And I'm Robin Allender, and it is the 23rd of December. Happy birthday to my brother Tom.
Happy birthday, and happy birthday for you for 2 days ago, which is, at the time of recording, what, 1 week in the future?
Yeah.
Not to ruin the magic of radio / podcasting.
Yeah.
But a very warm welcome and very happy festive jubilation to you all. We're going to talk a little bit about Get Back for the next hour or so, as well as hearing from a lot of ghosts of podcast past and present and possibly future. Unsure of the future of the podcast at the moment. We might be backed. This might be our last ever one. So strap in and let's beetle on.
We need a serious program of work if we want to make this work in the future. No, I'm just joking. That's one of my favourite Paul quotes. It could be like an aspirational quote, you know, like in an office, a serious program of work. Anyway, yes, we hope to come back in the future. I think we'll take a break next year. But yeah, we'll see how it goes. But yes.
Before we get started, I just thought I'd remind you that we are nominated for Best Music Podcast at PodBible's Winners Poll 2021, and you can still vote for us until the end of December. So we'd massively appreciate it if you did. You can go to podbiblemag.com and vote for us in the music section. You can also vote for us in the Best Independent Podcast category, I assume, because we are an independent podcast. So yeah, if you do that, you'll make us very happy indeed. So we'll be hearing from some fantastic people, and we've got a little switchboard here of stuff. Some of the people you know are going to give us some questions about Get Back, some about other things, some controversial opinions, and we've got some little buttons here, and you're going to, every now and then, we're going to press one, and we're going to get a question. So, you know, choose wisely.
But yes, Get Back. Have you done the double? Have you watched it twice? Or?
I've watched the first two twice.
Yeah.
And then it seems like quite a while ago that we watched 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
And we've given you a little bit of our thoughts on it, but we've been saving the sort of real deep dive for Christmas. Hope you're all not sick of it now, having seen it hundreds of times.
I just think it's nice to just have, you know, like I've watched it twice now, but it's also nice to just have on in the background as just ambient. You know, just you look over and you're like, oh, there they are.
Yeah, my girlfriend's been enjoying that as well, apart from the more sort of shouty, screamy bits.
Right.
Where she's like, what is this racket? particularly the bit where they get very drunk after George leaves.
Well, but that, I mean, as I think I mentioned it before, but something about the Beatles podcast with an interview with Peter Jackson, he does a very good rundown of when they're at their most drunk.
Yeah. Pissed watch.
Yeah. But there is pissed watch. Yeah, there is the day when they do the recce on the roof of Savile Row, they start firing into the Scotch and Cokes and do about 4 or 5 run-throughs, Let It Be, and they are absolutely smashed. It's really quite funny. But yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, now you've had a couple of weeks to sort of digest it. Is there anything that, having gone through it a second time or having that time to let it percolate, that has really sort of stuck with you? I know we both had a very sort of visceral, emotional response to the first time we saw it.
Mm. Yeah, I think one of the main things is to this idea that it feels like they're from the future, as in it feels like they're totally contemporary to us now. That's the hardest thing to get your head around. Like, so there's a couple of bits I just noticed on the rewatch. One is, do you know that bit when they're in Savile Row and the Beatles are all somewhere else and all the engineers have started getting up and playing, you know, playing on the bass and the drums? I think Glyn Johns is playing the bass as well.
Mm.
And they just resort into doing this kind of skiffly, bluesy thing. And you're thinking, yeah, that's probably what someone at that time would have played, you know?
Yeah, Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
the Beatles seem to have be in tune with all the music that's going to come in the 70s. It's before, obviously, disco. It was before punk. You know, it's before, you know, prog was in its infancy. You know, there was so much incredible experimental music in the 70s, you know, before glam. And, you know, but somehow the Beatles, it's like almost like they're attuned to all that. It's almost like they're post it somehow. They seem to have be keyed in to the music of the future somehow.
Yeah.
And they kind of have an extraordinary awareness of cliche, like Paul McCartney talking about corny chord changes, like they're like a pair of drainies, you know that?
Yeah, bit. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the bit I spotted was like Ringo starts spinning his sticks in his hand as a joke. And it's like drummers were doing that in the 80s without a shred of irony. How are you that far ahead of the game? You know what I mean?
But and we touched on this before, but it is that weird thing of like, that they just seem out of place with the iconography of the time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
even sort of Mal Evans's sort of cowboy jacket looks like pathetic by then. You know, it looks very sort of passé and like something out of the Pepper. But and they just look like they're sort of dropped into this thing. And maybe it's because they're just, we know those personalities so well and they're so sort of iconic. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Even the bit that there's a sort of hint of the beginnings of Castle of the King of the Birds, where Paul's playing when no one else has turned up. And it's very, that's very proggy.
Yeah, it is. It's playing during the credits of episode one, isn't it?
Well, he's working out with Mal at the bit where he's playing him things like Backseat of My Car and Another Day and a lot of, you know, when the other Beatles haven't turned up, he's basically just, you know, playing around with things that will end up on RAM in a few years' time. But he plays the beginning of that and the caption calls it Castle of the King of the Birds, whereas I think it's called Palace of the King of the Birds at some point. But that doesn't surface until the 70s. I think it's on the Rupert the Bear soundtrack or something like that.
But like, the Clientele tweeted about that as that being one of their favourite kind of Beatles outtakes. And it sort of, it totally makes sense. You can hear, you know, the Clientele in that as well. So, I just think they're just looking forward to so much stuff, you know, so much creativity in the 70s. And they seem completely timeless.
Yeah.
So what are your feelings about Get Back, having kind of had a bit more time to digest it?
I think the overwhelming thing for me was just seeing the interpersonal nature of it at first. And now the kind of dust has settled on that and I feel I know them a little bit more. I suppose I'm getting to know the music again because I sort of heard a lot of stuff I hadn't heard before on the Let It Be Super Deluxe, and then I saw it in action and now I've kind of gone back to the records. Definite new love for the Glyn Johns stuff. Mm. I think it's now more than a bonus CD for me. It will be something that I still that I go back to a lot more. And I think a lot of it is just kind of, I felt like it was going to tie up a lot of loose ends, but actually there's a lot more yarn hanging around the floor, really.
Yeah.
I mean, so much more kind of regret of what these things could have become. And I think we'll be hearing from a past guest a little later on who kind of sums this up perfectly.
Yeah.
But now, as you see it as a whole, it's more for me now a film about sort of the creative process, really, and about charging through the barriers that come up when you're struggling with relationships or creative ideas that have, like, falling into a hole. And having seen a lot of friends and people that I sort of follow on social media who are not necessarily massive Beatles fans who are absolutely loving it, what they grab onto is just watching people who are sort of bona fide geniuses create something out of nothing. And I think that's the kind of universal thing, and that's why I think Alexis Petridis is completely wrong about it being something for the fans. I really don't think it is.
No.
It might be too long for the average fan, and maybe there should be an agnostic cut that's like 2.5 hours.
Yeah, but it's as long as a series, though.
Yeah, exactly. If it was a 6-part Netflix series, then people wouldn't bat an eyelid about it. It's just because it's in such major chunks, but I think you do have to spend that amount of time with them uncut, because that's how you, I know that's how a lot of people binge those series anyway, but that's how you get into the rhythm of their thinking.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, I just love it more and more, yeah. I must say.
I mean, now that's the thing as well, is the length. I tried to sort of say this in an earlier intro, but that idea that we're used to seeing the kind of documents from the past as, you know, you're used to seeing the Beatles in kind of montage, let's say.
Yeah.
And I think something strange happens to your sense of time when you're watching it, because it's a short period of time, but they actually catch the feeling of the kind of languor, the kind of length of time that they were spending, you know, trying to come up with ideas or trying to fix a song or something. So, you kind of get a weird sense of time with it. If it's, yeah. it's a short and long space of time at the same time.
Yeah. And you've done a lot more sort of professional musicianship stuff than I have. But I've had, you know, periods where, I've been working against the clock in a studio. And so you're very aware of you have a finite amount of time to sort of get these things done. And what's interesting is that they do have it, but it's over a massive scale. So whenever I've recorded in a studio, it's been like, we've got 4 hours to do this. And you know exactly what you're putting down before you're going in. But even then, you have to cut your loves. And a lot of it, the way that they're just completely unsatisfied with the final product, and that they feel that, like he says, when their back's against the wall, they do their best stuff. And you can see that sort of come across.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
And also, you know, you're right. Yeah, they obviously weren't satisfied with how it ended up. But I think, Paul particularly, obviously, but I think the way the film captures this period of conflict, but also harmony, the fact is they are getting on, and the rooftop concert is so kind of emotional. And then it's kind of knowing how kind of things went awry afterwards that makes it kind of such a sad watch, you know.
Yeah, especially because there's, you know, this is very close towards the end. And even when Paul leaves, we'll talk a little bit later on, because one of the questions we got is about a particular scene where John and Paul are discussing in very frank and very emotionally mature terms, the dynamic with George and how that is basically unsolvable. When you can see that moment when George leaves and Paul is just utterly convinced that he's going to be back. He's not too worried about it, because they know that Ringo's left before.
Yeah.
And he comes back and he knows that George comes back. And this is kind of that thing of, it's how many last chances do you get? And luckily, this was the time where people did come back. But and then you obviously see the Alan Klein stuff, and you know that that's the kind of death knell, really.
Yeah. I mean, the lovely thing Peter Jackson said, again, in that podcast, is the idea that so many of the received narratives of that period came from the fact that people just had the audio. You hear about George leaving, and you hear the way they discuss it afterwards. But obviously, without the visual, you don't see that kind of hug between Ringo, John and Paul at the end of that day.
Yeah, you know.
And so, like, the way that Get Back kind of changes the narrative through those kind of visual cues is hugely important.
Yeah, and a lot of that is going back to the time thing of just giving yourself the time to tell those stories, which is the whole leaving the band thing. Yeah. It is very abrupt and sudden, but it's a slow burn, and it's been building up to that. Yeah. And so you're more sort of sympathetic to him.
And also, it's brilliantly cut, isn't it, the way that whole scene, because it's just, you know, John and Paul totally bonding over Two of Us.
Yeah.
And George getting more and more left out. And, you know, cinematically, it's, like, really well done, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think you see that a lot at Twickenham, is that the better they get on, the more he feels left out.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And there's a bit where, I mean, Michael Lindsay-Hogg, I don't think, comes across brilliantly in the film.
I like him.
You do like him?
Well, he's eccentric.
He is eccentric, but the way that he's trying to sort of, there's a couple of moments when he's trying to tell
2,000 Arabs.
He is obsessed with 2,000 Arabs, but there's bits when he's trying to sort of tell Linda that he's a bigger Beatles fan, trying to tell George Martin about the relationship that John and Paul have with George and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, come on, mate. And he's like, I'm a bigger fan than you. It's that's pathetic.
Yeah. But also, the kind of, I'm just staggered by how productive the next 2 years were as well. I mean, talking about things went awry, but creatively, it's extraordinary what Paul, John and George achieved in 1970 and 1971. It's just mad. You know, there's obviously Plastic Ono Band plus all the singles. You know, there's Imagine was 71. You know, you've got Ram, Wildlife, and the McCartney album. You've got All Things Must Pass, and you've got the concert for Bangladesh.
And that's just and the musical side as well. There's all the activism and all the, you know.
So that's just in 70 and 71. That's insane.
Yeah. And but you can see it bubbling over. I mean, that is all the germs of those ideas are kind of there.
Precisely. And that's what you can see. Is like, yeah, it's almost like the Get Back sessions are kind of like, yeah, that melting pot of all the ideas and songs that kind of, including obviously Concert for Bangladesh, really, because like they're almost kind of leaning towards doing something like that at one point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly that grand ambition that they have. I mean, loads of them are very sort of, you know, plucked out of the air. And there's that idea that where Paul's like, we should just get like the editor of the Daily Mail. Yeah,
really,
and
all the hottest serious news guys. I like John Lennon just going on about, we get plastic scaffolding, yes, or scaffolding. We can see through it. And he's just making notes and stuff, you know, just writing this thing.
But it's properly visionary. And even the stuff of throwaway comments about Paul being like, maybe we should do it in a farm in Scotland. And Linda's like, he's always going about farms.
Yeah.
it's almost like a badly written kind of drama where you're doing a kind of origin story of where these people are going to
Pink Floyd in Pompeii is obviously kind of that's kind of where they were trying to go.
Yeah, of course, I didn't really think about that connection. Yeah, I thought that too,
what
Siri.
What the fuck was that?
That was Siri.
Oh, right. Sorry, I swore.
But even when you're hearing Paul play stuff that ends up on Ram, and you just cannot imagine things like Backseat of My Car as Beatles tracks.
No.
And they're very obviously on their own trajectory.
Yeah.
And so it does feel very doomed. And it's great that we're kind of safe in the knowledge that the Abbey Road kind of happens. It doesn't feel quite as tragic.
No.
And it would be a lot harder to stomach if this really had been the end. Do you want to do a question?
Yeah, let's do the first question.
Okay, so do you want to pick... we've got a little load of pads here with different colours. Do you want to pick a colour?
I'll go for purple.
Purple. Let's see who's behind this door.
Hello, gentlemen. This is your former guest, Jeff Lloyd. Yeah. Let me tell you something. I regularly have pangs of anxiety about having been, a slightly underwhelming guest on your otherwise excellent podcast. I am here processing my feelings that you are at the end of the series. It's difficult, but I know that we listeners gave our screams, but you gave your nervous systems. And I look forward to the inevitable reunion, be it on Saturday Night Live for an amusingly paltry sum of money, albeit when one of you has died, and I think we all know which one is going first, and then the other one takes some outtakes of the podcast and makes something new for us, which, although it can never be the same thing, will still have some magic in it. Anyway, I have a question for you, which is, in the wake of Peter Jackson's Get Back, the old nugget about the Beatles producing and starring in a film version of Lord of the Rings has been doing the rounds again. And I would like to know, what other classic films can you imagine but starring the Beatles? Just to start the ball rolling, how about Star Wars with Paul as Luke Skywalker, John as Han Solo, George as Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Ringo as, shall we say, Chewbacca? I almost suggested Darth Vader, but I didn't want it to come across as a character slur in any way.
Wow, that's a great question.
And I would say Ringo, I mean, I hope this isn't too mean, but he's probably R2-D2, isn't he?
I mean,
The short, funny one.
Yeah. I mean, this question reminds me of is, you know, in the first episode, they keep going on about Around the Beatles. Let's do something like Around the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
I watched that the other day. Have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't.
It's absolutely fantastic. It's so fascinating. It's quite chaotic. But it starts with them doing a bit of Midsummer Night's Dream. Because they're playing in the round.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen clips of that.
Yeah, it's so funny. And, you know, it's John and Paul as Pyramus and Thisbe. George is the moonlight. And Ringo is the lion. And it's very, very, like... It's really well done, but like it's so ramshackle and chaotic. But I did think, though, Ringo as the lion is Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, which Paul hasn't seen.
Really?
Which comes up in the film. Yeah, because he's playing Long and Winding Road, and Mal goes, "Oh, it's a bit like Wizard of Oz."
Yeah.
Have you seen that? And he says, "No."
Well, I think in the 50 years since, he might have seen it, surely.
Yeah, but it's been out for 25 years. I would wager that it's still quite a big deal, The Wizard of Oz.
That reminds me of Jeff Dyer wrote a book about Stalker, the Tarkovsky film, which goes from black and white to colour.
Yeah.
And you'd think, wouldn't you, if you're going to write a book about Stalker, you might try and also see the other famous film that goes from black and white to colour.
Yeah.
But he said he's never seen Wizard of Oz.
But then also, the other one that does that is one of the most influential films of their lives, which is The Girl Can't Help It, which is in the anthology, when he's like, one of their first memories is when the guy comes on and clicks his fingers and he goes, "Glorious Technicolor." It's amazing he's never seen The Wizard of Oz.
Extraordinary. If we're doing Wizard of Oz, though, let me just see. So Ringo Lion, because full guy, kind of funny.
He's got courage.
Yeah.
But he's not that weedy, I guess. But yeah, I would say, I would say George Tin Man.
George Tin Man, if I only had a heart. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I can sort of see that. I think, wait.
Who's going to be the Scarecrow?
I was going to say Scarecrow is John.
Yeah, and Paul Dorothy.
Yeah.
Fair play. I think that's about right.
Well, I think that's about right.
I mean, we've talked about how that the sort of
can I open
the relationship. Yeah, yeah. Oh, we should say it's Christmas. I mean, we're having cans. We've talked about the sort of dynamic of those four and how they sort of often represented by archetypes. And we talked with Mae Martin about the Friends and the Ninja Turtles and stuff. And all of those are TV people. And because Jeff does a fantastic podcast about Succession, of which you can hear the final episode with Jesse Armstrong. Today.
Oh, yeah.
And who also betrayed the fact that he's a massive Beatles fan.
So do you think you could line up the characters with Succession?
Well, no, I thought it's great that he's asked about film specifically because it would be too hard to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I went for Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because you've got Venkman's John. So, exactly. Venkman's John. Ray is Paul. And then Egon is George.
George, yeah.
It's like the, cerebral one.
Yeah.
And Winston is Ringo because he sort of comes in late.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah. But that was a great question. Thank you very much, Jeff. And also, don't be ridiculous. You were a fantastic guest.
Yeah.
And if you haven't heard Firecrotch and Normcore and you like Succession, then go and check it out. It's really brilliant.
Should we go for another colour?
Yeah, do you want to do another colour?
I'm going to go for this. What would you call this? Like a kind of aquamarine? Or?
I would say turquoise.
Lovely.
Or aqua, which of course is French for water.
Hello, guys. Josh Widdicombe here. I love the podcast, and I'm glad you've had another wonderful year of it. Merry Christmas. And I thought I'd give you a controversial Beatles opinion for you to discuss, which is, when DJing, if either of you have ever DJed at a party or a wedding, despite them being the greatest band ever with a string of hits, there's not really any good Beatles songs that you could put on to confidently fill the floor. Discuss. Excited to hear your views.
Well.
That's a great one.
I mean, as someone who's played a lot of Beatles on record and in person at a lot of weddings, I'm beginning to think there's a reason why I don't get paid.
Well, but, first off,
do you think? I think it just depends on the kind of wedding. Because my sister's wedding, I played nothing but 1962 to 1964 Beatles.
Nice. Well, first off, you've got to make sure that your speakers aren't too far apart.
That's
true. Or you're playing mono version.
Especially if you're going into the split
but
stereo.
What springs to mind is Ed O'Brien, when he did his little interview with Paul after the 3 remixed album came out. He said he was, I can't remember, they were in, wherever they were, in LA, I think, and Questlove was DJing, and he played Paperback Writer, and he said
it absolutely
slapped.
Yeah.
And I think you're right as well, with the early stuff, up to 65, 66.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't be spinning Eleanor Rigby at a wedding. maybe that's where Stars in 45 come back in. But no, I think certainly for me, All My Loving is a massive dance floor filler.
Yeah. I mean, it comes back to our old friend talking about funk in the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the funkiest Beatles song? I've decided
it's poo-pooed by Matthew E. White when you brought that up.
But I think I've thought about it long and hard, and it is Three Legs off Ram. So not technically a Beatles song, but the end bit is really funky.
It's true. And if we're going to go that far, I would go as far as to say the break in, if you can call it a break, in Band on the Run. Mm. The
Yeah, but then you'd kind of have to loop that bit. I don't know.
But if you would use it as a break.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm always using stuff as breaks.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that definitely the early stuff, surely you could put, actually, no, Come Together's too slow, isn't it, to dance to.
Yeah, I think, you know,
I'd be boogieing to that.
Yeah. But yeah, you're certainly right. There's a cutoff. It's probably the cutoff is right when they stop playing live, really.
Yeah.
But great question. Thank you very much, Josh.
Yeah, thank you, Josh. That was brilliant.
Do you want to do one more?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to go for this light yellow.
Hello to all at your own personal Beatles. Tis I, John Robbins, here, one of the most controversial guest choices on the programme. But I've listened back to our episode and it makes for dynamic debate. I've since learned that another Queen Beatles connection is that David Wigg, who interviewed the Beatles in the past, also interviewed Freddie Mercury in the 80s and was good friends with him and gave a very moving account of one of their interviews in the documentary Freddie Mercury, The Final Act, which I watched recently and cried at 6 times. Speaking of documentaries, you've asked for any thoughts and feelings on Get Back, the new 8-hour documentary, which is too long. And unfortunately, I haven't seen it, but I have heard Ellis give an account of his thoughts and feelings, which people can hear on episode 186 of the Ellis, James and John Robbins podcast from BBC Five Live. And it remains the most bored I've ever been on radio, as Ellis discusses what it's like to find out how many cups of tea they drink, how often they drink sandwiches, and that Paul McCartney used to use a Cockney accent to deflect tension. So there you go. What a wild ride it's been for us all in the whole Beatles Queen debate that will rage for many millennia to come. But I thank you for your content, Beatles-based. I thank you for having me on to offer a different point of view, to challenge received wisdom. And I hope it wasn't too much of a chore for Beatles fans to listen to, because you can always just skip to the other ones. So Godspeed to the Fabulous Four, and all the best from me, John Robbins. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks very much for that, John.
Yeah, thanks, John. Queen Beatles Connections.
Yeah.
Jack, what do you got?
Well, one thing I should say is I did watch that documentary on BBC iPlayer, and it's really brilliant. It's very emotional. Mm. And I watched it the same day that I listened to John Ronson's new podcast about a very similar topic. Mm. So it does a very good job of balancing like Freddie's last days with a broader documentary about sort of AIDS epidemic. And but there's lots of joyous stuff in it, and it's worth watching, if only for you get to hear the split track versions of The Show Must Go On, which has Freddie's finest vocal performance on it. And I know that when John was on the podcast, we had a bit of a slagging match about that, yeah, of which I was admittedly in the wrong. But yeah, Queen, the only one I can think of is that I believe that the piano that was at Trident is the same piano that Freddie recorded the piano part for Bohemian Rhapsody, is the piano that Paul recorded Hey Jude on.
Mm, yes.
Even though the rest of it, I think, was done at Rockfield in Wales or something.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the other, you know, Hey Jude stuff, was probably mixed at Abbey Road. Yeah. But that's the only connection I can think of, apart from the fact that all of Queen were obviously big Beatles fans, which John doesn't seem to countenance.
There's a lovely Brian May video where he's got the multi-tracks of Bohemian Rhapsody, and he's talking about how the Beatles were just, I think he says the Beatles were God, or the Beatles were our Bible, in terms of recording techniques. In terms of double tracking and triple tracking and stuff. So, yeah, there is obviously the influence, the anxiety of influence thing, I think, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, great stuff.
Yeah.
Should we do one more?
Yeah, sure.
What colour would you like to pick this time?
Have I done light green?
Yeah, I'm done light green. Let's give it a go.
Hey, Jack and Robin, this is John Ronson talking to you from Central Park, appropriately. I am perhaps 10 blocks north of the Dakota and Strawberry Fields. I'm walking the same lawns that John and Yoko walked in that footage of them walking through Central Park. I really hope this isn't your swan song, because I think you're an excellent podcast. Maybe in 50 years' time, somebody will make a documentary about how everybody thought it was Jack that broke up the podcast, but actually Jack turned out to be much more delightful and less abrasive than everyone thought, and it was in fact Robin. And I hope that you return, and if you don't, you can feel very proud of the fact that you did something great. Bye.
That's really nice.
Wow.
Oh, that was so nice.
What a dream.
Gosh.
It's very flattering. And what a backdrop.
Yeah.
A real New York wind.
Yeah. That was so nice. I mean, God, I felt so much anxiety about this podcast, and to hear John Ronson say it's good is like quite a... It's given me a hell of a boost. But that's extraordinary. And, I've been to Strawberry Fields and Central Park, and it's a very haunting area, really. It's extraordinary to go there, I think.
Yeah, I remember the only time I've been to the actual Dakota, and it was... I don't know, it seemed there was something a little bit sort of weird about the fact that it was such a flagpole part of the open bus tour that I was on, because it's a relatively macabre piece of history. But yeah, you definitely do feel it around there, and the fact that it's synonymous with John and Yoko is quite strange, considering where it all comes from.
Yeah.
It's a long way from Mendips.
Yeah.
But thank you so much to John. Special thanks to John, really, because he was the first, one of the first people we got to do it that we couldn't quite believe was doing it. And it was a real joy to do. And if you haven't heard that one, it's a fantastic podcast. We talk a lot about sort of conspiracy theories and a lot of things that John talks about brilliantly. And if you haven't heard his most recent podcast, Things Fall Apart, it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Sometimes where it takes John to sort of wade in on these big issues to make sense of them in a really sort of glorious way.
So
thanks so much for that, John.
Yeah, thank you, John.
What's next?
Have I done orange? Have I done red?
You've not done red.
This is Christine Feldman Barrett from Brisbane, Australia. Jack and Robin, thanks so much for having me on your utterly fab podcast. And at the end of the year, I guess a question I'd really like to pose to the two of you is, what kinds of books would you like to see come out about the Beatles in the coming year or so? As you can imagine, as someone who's written a book about the Beatles, this is something I think about quite a lot. I've got my own set of favorite Beatles books, and I do think there are more stories to be told. But I'd like to hear what you have to say about this. So have at it. Over to you both.
Such a good question.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Christine.
I had a immediate answer to this. Because I think someone like, Joe Wisby might be able to tell us if this exists. Mm. But there seemed to be no books about the Beatles' influence on sort of hip-hop, really. Which I would find really interesting, because you hear every time, like every now and then you'll hear a snippet of some, huge hip-hop artist talking about how important the Beatles are to them. And I know the Beastie Boys especially were massively into the Beatles, and Kanye goes on about the Beatles. Yeah. But there doesn't seem to be
about the Grey album was as well.
Exactly.
Absolutely huge, wasn't it?
And obviously that song Black Beatles came out a few years ago that became a big craze. But there doesn't seem to be, to my knowledge anyway, a book about how the Beatles, which is a band that was very much formed from black music, sort of came back into the sort of black music sphere in the 80s and 90s. So that would be my answer.
Yeah, I think Rob Sheffield touches on it in Dreaming the Beatles a little bit. But that's a great shout. And for me, I thought... And this is kind of post Get Back. I'm really interested in the tech side of things, but I also don't really know much about it really. So my thing watching Get Back was I thought they only had 8 tracks here. They've got four track machines. So it's how have they got all these mics? I didn't understand that. Right. Surely you've only got 8 mics you can use. I'm a cretin, but I had it explained very well to me by my good friend James King, who's a sound engineer, that back in the day, and he's such a huge fan of Glyn Johns, he watched it the Get Back and was just like, yeah, Glyn Johns was the man. You know, like, but like you could basically, you could have multiple inputs on a track. So that's how they did it. Yeah. It's still kind of quite hard to do. But on the rooftop, they had a spare track, which is quite extraordinary. Yeah. So what I'm rambling about is, I think a book about the tech of the time, because the tech has changed so much, but made very accessible, would be really good. So something kind of just explaining it in almost a pop science way about what was happening, how they went from like two tracks to four to eight, and how they were able to do a kind of quite complex live recording that was happening in Savile Row and on the rooftop would be quite good. Obviously, you've got to say Solid State by Kenneth Womack is a great book about the making of Abbey Road and the more technical side of it. But, you know, I'm sure books like that exist, but something that's kind of... What's great about Get Back is I do think there's something for everyone. I do think lots of people can get something out of, like, the technical questions, like, what's happening here? Why are they worried about the monitors? What are monitors? You know, like, you know, what's happening? Why are they saying get rid of the bass on the guitar here? You know, all these things I think are really interesting.
Yeah.
So I think a book about that would be really, really good.
It's funny. I saw my friend Jimbo, who produced my track on the covers challenge we did the other day. Not a Beatles fan, although coming around, I like to think. But I said, what was your favourite bit of Get Back? And he said... watching Glyn Johns set up the mics on the drums.
Yeah, yeah. his drum mic technique is famous.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And to see that for him, it was absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
But this seems like a very apt time. Mentioned at the top of the show that it's your birthday quite soon.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look behind you, there's a little present there.
Oh my God, I thought the mug was the present.
You can open it
wow.
on the show.
Shall I open it now?
Open it, yeah, why not?
Thanks, Jack.
Happy birthday.
Appreciate it. This is special.
I'm very bad at wrapping presents.
This is great. It's kind of gold lame, it looks like.
I mean, it's very apt for what we're just talking about.
Oh, wow. It's a 1,000-piece jigsaw of Abbey Road Studios EMI TG12345 mixing console. That is really, really amazing.
The first solid-state mixing console that is
extraordinary.
Ever had. So there we go.
Wow, that's brilliant.
I know you're an advocate of dry January.
Yeah.
So, that's
fantastic.
That should do.
Thank you so much, Jack. That's brilliant.
So hopefully you'll be able to know what all those little knobs
do
in there
for
sure. Slightly better.
That's so cool. Wow, thank you.
You're very welcome.
That's brilliant.
Happy birthday to you.
Thank you. The other thing I was going to say... In terms of the books, the question from Christine, I think more books that do things that are a bit more like Kevin Barry's Beetlebone, in terms of novelizations, like fictional kind of ideas about what was happening, you know, I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah, I read one by accident that when Ellis James was on the podcast, he recommended a book called Love Me Do, I think. And I think his one was like a sort of biography of the nitty-gritty of the early touring years, and mine, I read the first chapter and it was about a couple having a tiff in a tent in 1963, and I was like, wow. Not sure this is the right thing, but actually I really enjoyed it.
There's an amazing book, it's called Murmur, and it's about Alan Turing, and it's this kind of incredible kind of fictional account of kind of what it was like to be him. And it's very dreamlike.
Because there's a bit in Ian McEwan's, one of his recent novels called Nutshell, where he does an alternative version of the 1980s in which the Beatles are still around and they're making horrible prog music and everyone's wishing they'd burn. But Alan Turing is also still alive in that version of events.
That's not Nutshell, though, is it?
That's Machines Like Me.
Yeah. I haven't heard that one. But yeah, Will Eaves is the guy who wrote Murmur. But I think something like that, some kind of novelization. We talk about the White Album a lot. There's a novel in the White Album, I think.
Yeah, well.
In the dream world of the White Album.
If you write it, they will come.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, a bit too much hassle.
It's too hard.
Great stuff. Let's dig back into the board. Do you want to do... You've got a choice now of pink or orange.
I'll do orange.
Let's do orange. Who's behind the door?
Hello, lads. Merry Crimble. It's John Bradley, I've got a quick question for you. It's Get Back related, but it's also a more general point as well. There's a lot of humour in Get Back. It seems to me that was something that Peter Jackson really wanted to focus on and bring to the forefront of things. The Beatles have an almost pathological desire, a need almost, to make each other laugh. And with that in mind, I just wanted to know, in your opinion, who is the funniest Beatle? Conversationally, just, you know, as a person in their own personality, in performance even, it could be. Just wanted your take on it, because I think they're all hilarious in their own way. I just wanted to know, in the humour stakes, as far as you're concerned, who's top of the tree? All the best, fellas. Many happy returns.
Well, that's a great question.
That's a really good question.
One that turns over in the mind a lot, and that Get Back, you know, definitely widens the field of sort of funny Beatle moments. I think humour, we touched on it before, but humour in that documentary specifically, is it kind of says everything, really, because it's a defence mechanism, it's a bonding mechanism, it's a way of getting out of sticky situations, it's a way of protecting themselves from the outside world. They all use it in different ways,
yeah,
which is really interesting. And all of them, I think it's worth, yeah, he's absolutely right. They're all really, really
funny.
They're
all really funny,
and
yeah.
There are loads of laugh out loud.
Yeah.
Minutes. Even the there's one where, in this one where he says, like, once more with Felix.
Yeah, that's good.
Which made me laugh a lot, which yeah. is Paul. But that's a very Johnny joke.
Yeah. Paul saying, calling Glyn John's fuckface is good.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. Yeah. Great humour.
I mean, I think the thing that I was struck by is, you know, you're familiar with, like, Charles Hawtrey and the Deaf Aid stuff.
Yeah.
But in Savile Row, John's doing that all the time. He's, like, constantly sick. There's one bit I wrote down, which is, after 40 years in the desert, he couldn't find his balls. He's just constantly singing these, like, daft songs. So I think there's a good case for it being John. But for me, it's George, because I think I really like George's dry
humour. It's
quite
cutting.
It's cutting, and it's like, you know, the stuff we've quoted before, but saying to Ringo, oh, you've learnt A minor, is really funny. And I like the bit where he's saying about, he's talking about how he was chatting to someone and said, they said, what do you need four speakers for? You've only got two ears. Like that. And you know, I just think the way he delivers a story. And I just really
but
feel for
they're always
George.
Quite barbed, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But I always feel for George because it's like that defensive thing of trying to get his voice heard. And he always thought, he does so much nervous laughter, George. I think George is so brilliantly funny, so dry. And yeah, you just kind of, a lot of the time you feel for him in the situation as well. So, and I think he uses humour as a bit of a defence mechanism.
Yeah. And Ringo, you know, Ringo is the great diffuser of any sort of tension.
I love farted.
The bit where he's farted is obviously fantastic. Weirdly, the stuff when Peter Sellers is in the room and they're in full show-off mode, I find a little bit like...
Well, I think John's on his...
He's
having
on his
a bad
absolute,
day there.
Yeah, he looks like he might have had too many...
heroin
drinks.
Yeah, but but John in that bit where he's looking to camera says he's doing the thing about the Boy Scouts, isn't
he says they died so we might wank.
But he says something like, you don't go blind, you do go short-sighted. And that is like speaking from experience. And that was like that is
a very cheeky look to camera.
He's very funny. And they all crack up, you know, it's great. It's a tough one, I think, because John is the obvious choice.
Yeah.
John's got funny bones.
They're very aware of where the camera is, whereas I think George is... Yeah, they all use it in different ways, really, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I would sort of have to go with the obvious answer and say John, really.
Yeah.
Well, should we give Ellis a rebuttal to John's claim that his pontificating about Get Back was very boring?
Yes, let's hear what Ellis has to say.
Hello, Robin. Hello, Jack. Oh, I've done it. I've watched Get Back in its entirety. I've now seen episode one for a second time, looking forward to watching episodes two and three again. It was a hugely compelling, engaging, on a personal level, very emotional watch. The Beatles anthology, I think I described it on the podcast one of the times I did it, is probably the most formative TV watching experience of my life. So that came out in November 95, so I just turned 15, and this obviously came out in November 2021, so I just turned 41. And honestly, when I was sitting there in my living room watching the Beatles create Let It Be in Abbey Road, I could have been 15 again. It brought back all of those same memories and feelings. And I sort of fell in love with the band again. Not that I'd fallen out of love with them, but I realised, seeing new material, just how much they mean to me. And also I realised that it has scratched an itch that I hadn't realised I had had for 25 years, where I've noticed that the one thing I want, no matter what the book is or the documentary is, no matter what I want, or the one thing I want, I should say, is that I want to see the Beatles be themselves, and not be the Beatles in a performative sense, in a sort of formalised press conference or something, or when they're giving an interview on TV. So just to see them, I mean, I've tried to argue online that they've invented the podcast because it's 8 hours of them just chatting. Yet another first from the Fab Four. But I found it soothing. I found it fascinating just watching them talk and eat toast and drink tea, and talk about their hangovers and Ringo owning up to having farted, which I loved. That was the one thing I'd always wanted, because I'd realised that no matter what book I'd read, it was the reported speech bits were always my favourite. So now, obviously, I have over 8 hours of it, and I will gladly watch it again and again and again, I'm sure. However, my question to you both is, bearing in mind that this book, I think, bucks certain received wisdoms, it dispels certain myths, and it breaks away from the received narrative. Can you ever take a Beatles book seriously again? Because I thought I knew how 1969 played out amongst the band, but I think I was wrong, massively wrong. And also, I think it was a more joyful experience than I'd been led to believe, which makes me very happy. I mean, on one stage, I think they probably could have gone on to make more music together had Alan Klein, etc., not got in the way and all of that kind of stuff. But still, what a legacy. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Brilliant stuff from Ellis, as always. Very surprised to hear he loved it. I mean, that was never really in doubt. exactly. Reiterating a lot of my thoughts there, but going to the question, just to pick up on something you said of like seeing them not being the Beatles, I thought what was very striking is how much they are the Beatles when they're not being the Beatles, and how sort of natural, once you've seen them in this environment, all of those press conference things are. They're just a heightened version of themselves, like a lot of people on stage are, but it's not an act. Mm. It's just them being, you know, a performative version of what their natural dynamic is. But in terms of, being able to trust and talking about the anthologies, I feel like I can't even trust the narrative in that, where they had complete control over it. Obviously, we're one Beatle down in terms of like editorial decisions.
Yeah.
But I think there's only so much you can spin the editorial when you're showing that much footage. And sort of, definitely with books, and in a year that I've, finally read the Mark Lewisohn book and, read more about the Beatles since we've been doing this than I ever have in my life, there's no substitute for watching them in their natural habitat.
Yeah.
Like, undoctored, really. Mm. Was that kind of how you found it?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, again, going back to this Peter Jackson interview on Something About the Beatles, one thing, in terms of the kind of received wisdom, you have to think about the fact of when Let It Be, the film, came out. And also the fact it looked dark. This is something Peter Jackson talks about, because of the way it was blown up, as they keep talking about.
Yeah.
And to the point where Peter Jackson was sort of saying to Ringo, George walking out wasn't that bad. And he was like, no, it was. There's almost like a false memory thing. But I do think that's really interesting. Like, one of the big takeaways from Get Back is I'd always just had this idea that George Martin was so hands-off about the whole thing. And George Martin is so actively involved and so gracious about Glyn John's working. You know, he doesn't want to, what's he say, cross change
says,
horses.
There's no point in changing horses in extreme.
And all that. But George Martin's also so full of enthusiasm for it. He's so involved. He's there every day.
It seems
to me, in Savile Row.
I mean, because I think he understands that thing that, I think we'll talk about this a little bit more, but the emotional maturity of them, considering they're in their sort of late 20s, and the that sort of analytical emotional skills that Paul have, especially in that one conversation. But there's other bits where Paul is talking about Yoko, and he's talking about George, and he's talking about Brian Epstein and their lack of, you know, the daddy figure, as he calls it.
Mr. Epstein.
I think George Martin knows that they need that. And he want, even though he's like relatively redundant in a sort of engineering way, he knows that him being there is going to make them behave in a certain way. And I think that his restraint and his stoicism in, you know, abdicating the responsibility of, like, being pulling all the strings is absolutely unbelievable. And he
He's also much more on their level than you would think from maybe the received wisdom, which is that he is the kind of father figure or, you know, an older generation. But he seems much more, he's in on the joke, obviously.
He gets the dynamic. No one else does. Because he's been there since the beginning, and he's only 10 years older.
Yeah. Back to Ellis's question, obviously, you know, as big revolution in the head people, you know, a lot of those kind of myths in that book kind of get exploded a bit, don't they? Like, you know, we've already talked about that, like, John's bass playing on Long and Winding Road. I think we had an email about this, but, you know, there's a bit in Revolution in the Head where he talks about John cruelly saying, you know, is it okay if we giggle in the solo about Let It Be? And watching it, it's right at the very end of part three when you see that bit. But, you know, after all the build-up, you know, there's nothing malicious in it at all.
No, completely. And it's something that if you got the transcripts would be... That might look a little bit sort of like it's a jibe. And also he talks a lot about some of the sequencing decisions being quite vindictive. Which has always been how I thought of it. But looking at it...
Having Maggie May kind of...
Putting in the stuff like Heart the Angels Sing and stuff. Yeah. Like Ian McDonald put forward that was like John getting his own back for Paul being a control freak. Now, I definitely question that sort of thing.
And I do.
I think those books, like Beatle books... They're great, but and Paul is the first one to say. I mean, we've talked about how he opens the lyrics book with a preface that basically says, "Don't believe any of these books." But they're nice to, you know, they're lovely to read, and we get stuck into them, and they're illuminating. And but I think you just have to take them with a pinch of salt, really, don't you? Especially now that you've seen. I said it right at the beginning in the first tweet that I did when the embargo lifted on the reviews was that I fell in love with them all over again, and I fell in love with John especially all over again. It's all there. And we've got, you know, one more of our little callers later on who talks about this very eloquently, but everything is there. The dynamic is there, even between the sort of more satellite characters, and it's just everything sort of fits together in a way that we've never seen before. It's just incredible.
Absolutely. And I was going to say as well that, you know, I think, again, Ian McDonald talking about John's attitude to Let It Be in Long and Winding Road. I just think those two songs, you can see in all the rehearsals, they're never quite coming together, because if you've ever played in a band, doing the slow songs is really boring. That's the thing. That's the thing. And there's a bit in Long and Winding Road where John has just got his head in his hands because he's so bored.
Yeah.
Fine, okay. But, you know, it's just, I just think it's just like, and Paul himself says, like, I don't know what to do with this one. I haven't got a clue, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, they're slower songs, they're ballads, and they're finding it a bit harder to kind of get the energy into them that they are for the more upbeat ones.
And they're so Paul-centric that they're basically session musicians on a Paul track.
Yeah, but I don't
know. Where you're playing an instrument that's not really your instrument.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? There's a bit where they're sort of jamming when they're drunk, and he's like, "What a buzz, man!" You know, smashing out and turning all the amplifiers up. He's like, a million miles away from trying to play like sensitive bass on a six string bass that when you're not a bass player.
Exactly.
I would be waiting for my turn.
Yeah. Isn't that really funny when they do For You Blue? And John says after, because he's playing that little Hawaiian slide guitar, and he says something like, "I was a phenomenon." It's so funny. I love that.
Yeah.
You know.
Hello,
Right, so which caller should we have now?
Pink button.
Hello, guys. Merry Christmas. It's Matthew Crosby here from Pappy's and from being my own man. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I had such a good time. When we were on the pod, we talked about the song Mr. Moonlight and especially how much we all enjoyed John's vocal intro to it, his a cappella intro, sort of basically screaming the words Mr. Moonlight. And Jack had a go, but I think he'd admit this. He didn't quite nail it. He slightly bottled it. So I wonder if Jack, and in fact Robin, would like to give us their Mr. Moonlight to get a second bite of the cherry to close off the year strong.
Nice.
Be great to hear it. I certainly know I'd love to hear it. So that's my request to you. Could we hear your Mr. Moonlights?
Right.
I need to hear it in my...
Do you have to do it in the original key? Because it's top B, which is pretty tricky. I will say that fair play to Matthew Crosby.
Yeah.
He's also given us... Because I thought maybe you might say you didn't want to do it.
I'll give it a
he's
bloody good
given,
go.
I've had three he's cans. Given his version.
Really?
Well. So after we've done ours.
Can I hear this? Can I just quickly hear the song? Because I just to kind of... I don't want to just shout Mr. Moonlight. I want to just...
No, I can play it for you right now.
Yeah.
I've got it all hooked up here. You don't have to do it in the original key because it is the highest note that
John
ever sang on record. And it's quite amazing that he managed it night after night. But here it goes.
Mr.
Okay.
Do you want to go first?
Can I stand away from the mic?
Yeah, I think that would be best for everyone.
I need to stand up.
Shall I go first?
Is that the melody?
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. Mr. Moonlight.
That was quite good.
For it.
Oh my god.
Fantastic work.
I mean, I let the irony creep in at the end, though.
I know, you got self-conscious.
I did.
Oh, you did much better than me.
No.
I can't
no.
have another go, though.
No, maybe
next year. Well, here's Matthew's version.
Mr. Moonlight.
Did he put reverb on that?
He didn't, but he said that he wanted to make it clear that he was in the dressing room of the last leg. He
did it. That's amazing.
Which is
that was pretty good.
Superb. It was good, yeah. I mean, he went for a comfortable range. I think that's a very good idea. Again, I absolutely fucked it.
No, don't. God, you're so down on yourself.
I know, but, you know, it's my thing, isn't it? The only reason this started because I was boasting about my party trick that I used to do at university, but... I must say, at that point, I was belting out the Dream of Gerontius all day, so my voice was quite shot at the end.
Bloody
but
well.
It's, yeah, I think John's voice is just so bloody great
yeah.
in that period, and that's testament to...
I mean,
you can only really sing like that if you've been singing all day.
Yeah, I mean, I shouted mine because my voice hurts now.
Well, I think you won, you won.
No,
great
no,
stuff.
No.
Yeah, do you want to pick the next one? You've got your choice of red, orange, yellow or green.
Hello. Hello, boys. On the Personal Beatles podcast. James Acaster here. I have a question for you. For Jack and indeed for Robin, I would like to know, as it's the festive season, what is the most Christmassy of the Beatles songs that you would put on around Christmas time? I'm not talking about the Paul McCartney song, the Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time, whatever it was called. It's a good song and I love it, but it's not a Beatles song.
I love
of all
it.
The Beatles songs, what's the most Christmassy?
Right, well...
That's great.
I mean, I think there is an answer to this, because although it's not very well known at all, and it's only sort of come back into the official sphere in the last sort of 20 years, there is a Beatles Christmas song.
Well, the Christmas fan club.
Which was part of the Christmas fan club, but it's later than you think. So it's sort of 1968, I think.
Yeah.
So it's in that kind of vein. Do you want to hear it? Have you never heard it before?
Well, I've heard all the Christmas fan club things.
Right, okay. So, and then it emerged in the 90s as a sort of cynical B-side on Free as a Bird, because that was released at Christmas time.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't get to number one.
I mean, and it's not, you'll hear why. But here's a little bit.
I'm sure, Rob, it's not.
Christmas time
I love the drums. Doesn't get a huge amount more interesting than that.
It's great. They're all so good. I mean, the great thing about the Christmas fan club things is, you know, you can hear, if you want to hear the Beatles' relationship with marijuana quickly illustrated to you, the difference between 64 and 65 will really bring that into view.
But I'm amazed they're still doing it at 68, because there's actually nicely recorded that, and there's some lovely stereo drum. But I would say, you know, because that's not common knowledge, what is the most Christmassy Beatles song for me? I thought long and hard about it, and it's the one that has, you know, a glass of red wine on a rug next to a fire. So it's got to be Norwegian Wood for me.
Nice.
That sounds like a Christmas party gone wrong.
That's a good shout. Okay, mine is a weird one, but what's good at Christmas? You know, if you're watching a film or, you know, reading a book, what emotion do you want to feel?
Do I want to feel?
Yeah.
I don't know, sort of coziness, I suppose. Fear. Right, okay, fear.
Ghost stories.
Right, yeah, I don't like that, things like that.
But M.R. James, Christmas Carol. No, Christmas is a great time for spookiness.
Too scary.
But the spookiest song is Revolution 9. So
okay.
That's my Christmas song.
Not coming to your Christmas party.
But, I mean, you know, it's spooky, you know, and again, you know, I'm always banging on about Cry Baby Cry, but...
What is Christmas about that? That it's spooky?
You never had a séance at Christmas? Yeah, spookiness.
That's the sound of people cancelling their plans to come to your Christmas do.
Don't you like how in the Paul McCartney Wonderful Christmas Time, the synth, the delay on the synth is slightly out of time?
Do you think that's to invoke a sort of spooky nature?
No, it's just like kind of nice and cool and not to a click.
Possibly
stuff.
A mistake.
Yeah, sounds great.
I mean, I always hated that song until I saw him at the O2 a couple of Christmases ago, and then he played it with and then a choir of children came out, and I was like, oh no, this is going to be awful. And something about the occasion just whipped me up into a real festive frenzy.
Well, that was a great question from James, you know, James Acaster, potential future guest.
Yeah, he's maybe. Going on a Beatles... Always been a Beatles agnostic, but...
No, he's going on a Beatles journey.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. Yeah. He asked me what was the best place to start, and he wanted the list of the albums in
great.
Terms of my favourite. Ding, dong, ding, dong, ding,
dong, dong, dong. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Next one. There's one I forgot here, which is the little blue one. Okay. So do you want to press that one?
Light blue.
No, the dark blue. Navy blue.
Hello there. This is Sam Carter from the band Architects. I just wanted to say I wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And I'm very, very happy to have found the podcast this year and have been absolutely loving it. My talking point for you guys is... the scene in Get Back when it cuts to the audio of the conversation between Paul and John in the canteen. Mm. How did you guys feel about that? I absolutely loved it and couldn't look away and found it so interesting. But there was also another part of me that was like, oh, maybe that was a line crossed. Maybe that was a conversation that should have just been left for two friends. And obviously it was a really interesting part of the film. But yeah, I just wonder what you guys thought of that bit. And yeah, I hope you have a great new year, and long may the pod continue. Oh,
cheers, so Sam. Nice.
That was great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... Yeah, someone got in touch to say that he was a fan of the show, and, you know, it'd be great to have him on, because I do think the kind of influence of the Beatles on metal is something which kind of we haven't discussed, and on hard rock and stuff.
No, I mean, yeah, I know a lot of sort of people who are into their hardcore and their metal who are big Beatles fans and would often cite Helter Skelter as the beginning of that for them.
Yeah, Helter Skelter for sure, like Ozzy Osbourne was a big fan. He says he used to work. Was it? He used to work in an abattoir, and would go out and have a pie in the pie shop. Remembered he was where he heard Strawberry Fields for the first time. It's such a great story. Lemmy is a huge Beatles fan. There's a great little video of him getting the mono box set in a record shop. You know, huge, huge Beatles fan.
Yeah. So it'd be great to have him on. I'm sure we will if we come back.
Yeah. I'm a big metal fan, but a lot of the best metal. The reason Metallica have sold so many records is they know what a hook is.
Yeah, and you know, similarly with Architects, and you know, a lot of you know, it's very melodic.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's something we definitely haven't explored at all, really. So, very, very interesting. And going to address the question.
Yeah,
I did feel a little bit voyeuristic. Mm. I must say, watching it, I guess the sort of slightly ickiness is the fact that the film crew decided to do it rather than the fact that we were watching it. I didn't feel too complicit in it because it obviously happened such a long time ago, but I think it would have been an editorial decision that they kind of struggled with, but it's so revealing that you can't really leave it out because it obviously is the only moment in the whole film where they're completely
unguarded.
And there really isn't much Beatles footage at any point where they're, you know, unawares. You know, when it's properly candid.
I think
the nature of the conversation sort of justifies its use, really.
Yeah.
Because they're not saying anything nasty. It's just a very illuminating little insight into the nature of their relationship. And the way that they chose to use the sort of graphics and the subtitles was really good as well. Because they're almost... Part of the captions is because the quality of the dialogue isn't great, but also because they're speaking almost in a kind of like Nadsacky half sentences that only people who are that close can kind of understand, and they're trailing off and they don't need to finish sentences. And that's really interesting because it's that sort of almost telekinetic nature of the way that they communicate, I thought was absolutely fascinating.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I think there is that private language. And you know, and they are confronting things, and you know, as you said earlier, in quite a mature way about McCartney's kind of bossiness, for want of a better word. Yeah, the thing that's fascinating about that bit is, like, as you say, it's kind of hard to think without the visual and the fact that they're talking in the kind of quite private language. It's hard to kind of figure out what's the subtext, what's going on underneath it somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know, like because
even when you are reading it and hearing it, you still, there's so much that's lost in obviously what was going on in between, sort of physically. Whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then I don't know. It's just, and then it strikes me how old they are. Mm. And I had this conversation with someone about that scene in the pub quite recently. To have the emotional maturity at the age of 27, 28.
Yeah.
If I had falling outs with people at that age, it was just like, oh, well, that was a formative relationship that's gone to bed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't have the sort of lexicon to
be
able to kind of... And the fact that
the
problem is unsolvable
is
what's really interesting, because they are like, you know, I don't know how we solve this.
Mm.
Maybe it isn't something we can do, but like, you know, it was like, it's a wound and we've allowed it to fester,
yeah,
you know.
God, yeah.
They're so aware of what's going on. It's not like they're being, you know, because you could be forgiven watching the footage to think that they're just not really thinking about George, but they're hyper aware of the situation.
But I mean, in terms of like Sam's question there about kind of the ethics of the filmmaking, I think there's a lot of the stuff that's a bit in a grey area. And again, I'm going back to this great Peter Jackson interview, but he says, you know, one of the interesting things about the George argument, you know, I'll play what you want me to play, is George is out of focus because the camera was fucking miles away and they were zoomed in on him because they didn't want them to be aware that they were being filmed.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is a lot of, you know, stuff like that, you know. But then again, you know, having a hidden microphone, that does seem to cross a line, doesn't it? But I think, again, that enough time has passed, I think.
Yeah.
It's a historical.
And it also speaks to this thing of, like, Michael Lindsay-Hogg not necessarily having their best interests in heart and caring more about the finished product. Mm. But, you know, that's filmmakers, I suppose, isn't it? You know, he's not their friend.
Yeah.
He's there to get this, you know, revelatory, candid portrait of what it's like to be with the Beatles. And I mean, if it had been in the original film, I think people would have asked more questions. But now 50 years has passed, that's kind of, it doesn't belong to them anymore. It's like it's part of the annals of the history of the whole thing. But it's a fascinating question and a fascinating part of the film.
And thanks so much for the question. I'm a big fan of Architects, and
Great. Who just did a big live thing at Abbey Road as well, in studio, I think in Studio One, which is pretty amazing. So you can check that out. I think I think it's out now, or will be at the time of listening. So cheers, Sam. Happy Christmas. Thanks Merry very Christmas. Much.
Right, shall we dive into another question?
Yeah, let's do it. You've got a green and an orange or a yellow.
Hello, it's Pictish Trail here.
Oh, cool.
Congratulations to Jack and Robin on another top series of Your Own Personal Beatles. I really enjoyed this series. It's probably my favourite one that you've done, not just because I was on it, although it was interesting to hear the range of Macca impressions throughout the series. I'll be honest, going into my episode, I was pretty confident that I had a good Macca impression, but... hearing your impression, Jack, on the Buxton episode and Sean Keaveney's amazing one. I've just stopped doing my Paul McCartney impression entirely, at least publicly. Anyway, I watched Get Back and what an amazing experience it was. I consumed all of it within 4 or 5 days, I think, and totally loved it. I was going to ask you if it had altered your perception of Yoko. One thing that jumped out at me just after I'd watched the first episode, I think, I saw a tweet from the Guardian music journalist Jude Rogers, and she'd written this. Tomorrow night we're going to watch Get Back. I just watched a clip that's been released. Yoko is sitting there impassive. And I suddenly remembered something I wrote about her a few years ago. In November 1968, she had a miscarriage when she was 6 months pregnant. The baby had been due 3 months later in February 1969, a month after the Get Back sessions. No wonder she was there. No wonder her husband wanted her close. What they must have been through. And that tweet from Jude really made me think about how Yoko was demonised and unfairly blamed for the breakup of the band, because in the show you see nothing but tenderness and respectfulness towards her and John from all of the Beatles, and by halfway through the series I found her to be a really sweetly reassuring presence, just sitting there knitting or reading a book, not intrusive in any way. I just wondered what your thoughts were on all that. Hope you have a great Christmas, and looking forward to more Macca impressions in series 3.
That was great. Thanks,
great.
Johnny.
Cheers, Johnny.
And that, I think that that really, to contextualise, Yoko is such an important detail.
Yeah, and something that I'm, like, considering they did make an effort to sort of editorialise quite a lot of stuff, you know, maybe a caption at the beginning to put that in a bit of context might have been useful, because I've seen both sides of this. I've seen people who have said that I find her really annoying. I completely disagree. I think you see that closeness. Mm-hmm. You see that obviously John is quite vacant, and you know, a lot of people would, you know, have pointed out that he might be under the influence of a few different things over the course of that month or so, and a lot of that I'm sure is directly related to, you know, that bereavement. Mm. But it's their closeness really that I think really shines through, and also the way that the other Beatles deal with it.
Yeah.
And it's just, they're so explicit in their support for them,
yeah,
which is why it's interesting to see just how far that's been taken sort of out of context, and obviously the famous like clip is the Paul joking about, you know, in 50 years' time, they'll be like, they broke up because Yoko shot on an amp.
Yeah.
But what he also says in that conversation when you see the whole thing is, you know, him being completely supportive of that, but also understanding that that is where the love of John's life is now. And him saying, you know, if John has to choose between being a Beatle or a Yoko, you know, he's going to choose Yoko.
Yeah, yeah. And also the lovely interview with the, you know, the fans outside. I don't really like to say Apple Scruffs, anyway, but the fans outside. Yeah. And they say, what do you think about the relationship with Yoko? And she said, well, you know, it's fine, it's his choice. And they're like, and the interviewer's like, oh, yeah, it's a good point. Yeah,
yeah, like no one's ever made that.
But, yeah, exactly. You know, and I should say as well, you know, obviously Yoko was demonised at the time, but I think, you know, Ian Penman, in that great London Review of Books article, said something good about Yoko, which is... She's not completely immune from criticism, you know. And I'm a big Yoko defender. Yeah, I'm just saying, let's not make it a kind of binary thing, you know.
Well, obviously there is an element of like, if you've ever been in, you know, everyone has gone through those formative relationships where certain members of groups fall in love and like tensions happen and breaking up the band, and you know, these old, those wedding bells of breaking up this old gang of mine or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's, of course, there's an element of that.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
just as much as there is with Linda. And there's a...
Yeah, of course.
Paul makes a joke about it when Linda has a bit of advice and he's like, all right, you're cool.
Yeah,
and he's sort of, you know, taking the piss out of the kind of press narrative of it.
Yeah,
and
of course
like, it would be, I'm sure, if in an ideal environment, she wouldn't have been quite so present. But also in an ideal environment... John might not, you know, he might not have even been there if she wasn't there. So,
of course,
I think they're very understanding of that. So.
I love her in it. I think she's brilliant. And I think her, you know, her vocalizing and singing is just fantastic. And it is like, you've got to think, this is 50 years ago. And I've seen comments online of people saying like, oh, you call that singing? Or like, oh God, what's Yoko doing? You know, and it's like, you know, it's just, if that was a, you know, if it was a man still now, I mean, this is 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, it wouldn't get that kind of response.
Yeah.
So obviously the amazing bit is Heather McCartney just being kind of completely gobsmacked by this incredibly expressive person.
Yeah.
Which is just,
and then sort of mimicking
brilliant.
That, and John's eyes lighting up and calling her Yoko. And...
Yeah. And it just like, it's in a funny way, it's like, I don't know, like, I'm a huge Kate Bush fan, and do you know the song Big Sky?
Yeah, yeah.
It's so incredible. And you just think, like, this is a pop song with a woman vocalizing and just making these crazy sounds.
Mm.
And, like, you know, there's who did that before, really?
Yeah, and exactly. Then, you know, and even, like, people like Bjork, who dismiss her as, like, she's a weirdo or a kook or whatever. And then, you know, someone like Tom Waits is, like, a genius for like gargling away in some of his more experimental stuff.
Yeah, sure.
There's always an undercurrent of inherent misogyny
totally.
That goes along with it.
And also it's just like there's so much of the kind of experimental noisy stuff happening. So it's like, why aren't you, drawing attention to John's just feeding back his guitar or Paul feeding back his guitar, you know, or just like...
Yeah, just making
about
a
like
joke
that.
Out of everything.
Yeah,
there's
a
really nice take going, and then he starts like doing a really stupid accent or whatever. You'd be like, oh, bloody hell, he's ruining it. But, you know, I think, you know, just as you think you can put those to bed, there's always going to be a few people that come out. But I guess, you know, the Beatles have always had to straddle that thing of being the most popular band in the world and still having an element of the avant-garde, which a lot of people would rather... wasn't in there.
Yeah, like that young guy in the street afterwards. They used to be all right, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, people say that about, like, Kid A.
Yeah.
You're always going to get that.
Yeah. I mean, Kid A is rubbish. But, no, I'm joking.
But, careful now.
But talking about out in the street, I think that was... I mean, obviously, there's a lot of those interviews on the original Let It Be film, but I think that it's such a amazing snapshot of London and... a snapshot of the kind of open-mindedness of people, which in many ways is surprising. And it
really subverts class and age in a way that the original film didn't necessarily portray.
Yeah, but true. But it reminded me of, have you ever seen the Jeremy Deller film, Everybody in the Place?
No.
It's really good. It's a film about, like, it's about rave culture in the late 80s and early 90s. And the film is Jeremy Deller giving a lecture to a sociology like A-level group and showing them this film, almost like historical footage of like rave culture.
Yeah.
And there's an amazing bit where Jeremy Deller has got footage of lots of people kind of going to the Equinox at Stonehenge for a kind of, you know, rave, I suppose. And and it kind of stops the video, and there's this older couple there, and he says, like, what do you think they're going to think of these people? And all the kids go, like, oh, they're really not going to like this. They're going to think, like, get out of our town, you know. And he presses play, and the old guy goes, oh, they're welcome to do what they want to do. You know, it's a free country, you know. Yeah. And it's like, and the woman says, you know, like, where are they getting their money from? And he goes, you know, if they want a drink, they can have a drink. If they want some money, they can have some of my money. I'll share what I've got. And he's like this incredibly, like, wise and just accepting.
Mm.
And it really reminds me of some of those people in Get Back who you're saying, you know, they brought a bit of life to London and stuff, where it's like, you know, you make these assumptions about an older generation, but it's an older generation that would have been through the war, or, you know, even been through two wars in the 60s, and then tolerance was very important.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I just think somehow we kind of lost sight of that recently, but like, I just think that generation had been through a lot. I mean, this is a slightly different generation in the late 80s to the 60s, obviously, but the older generation was a lot more accepting than you might think in some ways.
And I'm glad that they made an effort to, the whole way that they did that whole scene, because, you know, we've seen a lot of that footage and we know, you know, it's the most well-documented bit, or the most sort of, you know, uncut version. And the way that Peter Jackson decided to do it, of making the star of that show the audience, and because you've been so confined to those studios, to step outside of the door and see, it contextualizes what's going on in those studios in such a brilliant way.
And also, yeah, to see the kind of, you know, the things happening at the same time. So I think as they're doing I've Got a Feeling, which I think is the actual take ends up on Let It Be, that's the policemen arrive.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like all that weird serendipity is like all recorded really nicely.
And the stuff, just the stuff with the policemen. I love all these stories on Twitter of like people's parents spotting themselves in the footage and stuff. It's just amazing. It makes me proud to be a Londoner. Even though I wasn't born for 25 years afterwards, or 15 years, whatever it is. Mm. But yes, another superb question.
Yeah.
And well, we've got a couple more. We've gone on for a while, so we'll rattle through the last three.
We'll edit down, maybe.
Yeah, I think we probably will. Do you want to go orange?
Yeah, sure.
Hello. I'm recording this message. There's a baby on my chest.
It's Josie Long.
I feel like she has just done, at the best, a wet fart in response to your Christmas special. Despite the fact that I am a busy mother of two, I don't have Disney Plus. I haven't yet seen it. So what I would really love is if you could summarise how each of the Beatles comes across throughout the whole of the hours and hours of footage as quickly as possible for me. Like, are there any personality-based updates that you didn't expect? I doubt it. But that would be exciting for me. I'd also like you to tell me, like, what are the most charming bits of footage in your opinion, because I feel like there'll be loads of charming, sweet, silly moments that people have been expecting. That's my question. Not really a question, more a request. Goodbye
Josie. Thanks. That's very much great. For getting in touch.
Yeah, thank you, and congratulations on the new ABBA.
Congratulations. In terms of, I mean, I think we kind of touched on this quite a few times, but I'd say that the overall things for me was John just being much less spiky than I thought he would have been, and much more sort of emotionally available, considering like the previous narrative that he was pretty out of it. Paul being bossy and quite hard to get on with at the beginning, and then mellowing once he realises that his behaviour is breaking up the group. Ringo being just the absolute cement in the middle of it, and his drumming being absolutely superb, and, you know, why we're still having the debate about Ringo's drumming. Absolutely. Hopefully this will put that to bed.
Well, one of the debates as well is about John's guitar playing, and he's fantastic in that. I didn't even realise that was up for debate, but John's a brilliant guitarist. You can see throughout. He's so inventive. His solo in Get Back is brilliant, you know.
Yeah. And George, I think, being rightfully aggrieved.
Yeah.
And not being bolshy and having completely legitimate reservations.
That's a lovely scene with George and John on Yoko, where he's talking about, I've got all these songs, I just want to get out. And Yoko's going, yeah, you should, you know, and that's brilliant.
And John's saying, you know, it might make the Beatle thing strong. Yeah. It's going to help us in the long run to get him out. It just reinforces all of those sort of fraternal things. But in terms of charming moments, I think for me, the stuff with Heather is just so lovely.
It's beautiful.
And Ringo and Heather that we got a glimpse of in the trailer.
Yeah. You seem to be wearing the same costume at one point, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, the charming moments for me is, as you say, like, I just think John, particularly when they get to Savile Row, there's such an amazing naivety to him. He seems almost like, he reminds me of my 9-year-old nephew. There's this kind of toddler-like wonder and kind of interest in things as well.
Yeah.
And as I said, I mentioned somewhere else about his kind of slight technical naivety, you know, calling microphone stand sticks and stuff like that. And, you know, there's a lovely moment. It's just sort of happening in the background where they're lifting Leslie speakers in to the Savile Row. And John's helping lift one. And he does such a crap job. It's like the camera pans away and there was these like cables falling off the top. Like he's just done a terrible job. But there's a moment I just spotted, which is, you know, so John's playing his Epiphone Casino. And you know you've got your strap hook at the back. Mm. And he puts his strap on the wrong way round. You know, because of the back bits facing forward. And there's just this bit, a few minutes later maybe, where you see George put the strap on the right way round for him. And it was like, oh.
Yeah.
I just thought that was so touching. Yeah. Because I just think it was just, you know, they loved each other.
but
I thought that was so good.
It's beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
So the final one that we've got is from Matthew E. White, and he sent us a fantastic little ramble about how much Get Back meant to him. And to be honest, there's such brilliant points, and there's not really a question at the end that I've just sort of cut this down to what I think is basically the crux of the whole documentary that we touched upon at the beginning of the show, of it just being this fantastic portrait of the creative process. And it's amazing to hear him talk about that as someone who is a performer, as a musician, and as an engineer and a producer, and someone who is probably spent more time recording music in the studio than anyone else we've had on the podcast. So let's have a little listen to this to sort of play us out, and then we'll say our goodbyes at the end. But I found this quite touching and really quite illuminating.
Hey, Jack and Robin, this is Matt White. I'm going to ramble on about Get Back for a second. I don't know, it's been one of the highlights of my year watching that thing, and really one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. Just jaw-dropping for me as a producer and a songwriter. I actually just this morning finished the rooftop show, and I mean, I cried watching that. I cannot believe all the nuance that you get to see about being in a band and being writing songs with people, and it's all there, you know, everything about this world that's sort of annoying is there, and everything that's great is there, and they're so talented, but they also don't really think much of themselves at times. Just a really touching and a really personally important piece of film for me. I can't get over it. I could watch it. Probably will watch it 10 more times. It's amazing. It's just amazing. I think the main takeaway, so many times, maybe in the music business, I'm sure it applies to other parts of life too, but like when you think things are the worst, sometimes they're really not the worst. And sometimes they're extra special. And the struggle kind of sometimes is the point, even though at the time you don't want it to be like that. And they're in the midst of change. You can see that. But they're also in one of the most unique, special parts of their lives and some of the best work they ever did. And they seem so unaware of that. And maybe it's good to be unaware of it, but at the same time, I think it makes me really think about the situations that I'm in now or the relationships that I have now, maybe even some relationships that aren't ideal, and really try to dwell on the fact that the struggle is sometimes the point. Anyway, this is a couple thoughts. Appreciate you reaching out and having me on the show. Hopefully I'll see you and talk to you all soon. Thanks.
Mm. Very nice.
I think that's brilliant, isn't yeah. it? It's and so true. You know, for anyone who's tried to make any music, the struggle is usually the point where I put down tools.
Yeah. But also that unawareness, that's a really big thing, isn't it? That kind of, yeah, they're kind of slightly unaware of, obviously, of how well, I mean, particularly Let It Be, which is just possibly more than any other Beatles song has taken on a life of its own.
Yeah. And all, and lots of songs that they, you know, that end up on best ofs and that Paul still plays to his to this day. And I think, to sort of wrap up, I think that finally maybe Paul has kind of achieved, unintentionally through this kind of no holes barred view of making the album, what he's been striving to do for ages is to show, you know, to get something out of it. He wasn't sort of necessarily happy with it, and Let It Be Naked is a good stab of it, but there's a whole new audience of people who've seen this film. Mm. And I've spoken to lots of people, and someone, my friend Adam was talking to on Twitter yesterday, who is not a huge, I think, Beatles fan and didn't really know Let It Be, and he was like, oh, it's amazing that through all this struggle, they created probably their best album. Uh-huh. And it's like, well, Let It Be is in the bottom half of people's Beatles albums often than not. Well, that, but I think people now have a much higher regard for it, having seen the process and knowing the story and knowing, you know, the, why some of it is quite rough around the edges. And it's given the album this new life because there's now an abundance of context around it.
But even that's got another kind of, you know, because imagine you hadn't heard Let It Be, and then you watched 8 hours of that, and then you listen to it, you're like, what? Where? You know, because Spectre doesn't get mentioned, obviously, because it's a year later. But yeah, but it's a very... It's...
And maybe the beauty of the album is that it's not the masterpiece. Maybe it is just a brilliant... It's just a great document of four people at the peak of their powers trying to make something, and there's maybe the failures of it are actually more interesting.
Yeah, totally, yeah. And, I think... It's given you this full picture of something, and it's about the process, and so it's
the journey, not the destination, isn't it? Which is so true of so many things.
But why do we keep going back to them? Here's a little quote from Proust. I've gone full on Sood's corner, but melodies you replay 100 times in succession without descending farther into their secrets. But that's why we keep coming back. Isn't it?
It is. And as they always ask more questions than they answer, the more that you see of these things. Mm. And, you know, I don't think we'll ever get anything quite so revealing as this ever again. But, you know, it's delivered in every single way from when we first heard about this project. And what an extraordinary thing it's been. And how I've just been loved seeing how people have really gotten bored with it, buying the mugs and, you know, all the beautiful artwork and the lip service that people who aren't Beatles fans have been paying for it. It's just an absolutely extraordinary project done so well.
Yeah.
And thanks very much to Peter Jackson for doing it. I mean, it's quite incredible.
Yeah.
As Matthew E. White said, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So, we'll leave it there. We've rambled on for quite long enough. We'll take this opportunity at the end of the year to just say a massive thank you, I guess, to everyone who's listened. It's been an absolute joy to do for another year. Picked up loads of new listeners along the way and been, you know, achieved way beyond what our modest hopes for it would have been 2 years ago. It's quite unbelievable the people that we've been able to share time with and hear stories from. And, you know, the fact that they're personal stories means everything to us.
Yeah.
And,
and also, you know, I often think about things Joe Wisby said when we did the Beatles books things, you know, it feels like this podcast was the kind of the start of your Beatles journey. And I feel like it really was for me because I was obviously a huge fan when I was a teenager, but doing this podcast has made me learn so much and, you know, discover so much that I've just kind of, I thought I loved the Beatles, but not as much as I do now. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. It's opened up so many new worlds of it. And I think there is a singularity to them. And, you know, people of my friends who have been enjoying the podcast that say to me, like, oh, I didn't even know they were your favourite band. It's like, well, they are, but they also aren't. You know, they're just a constant in me that probably mean more to me than any other band. Mm. And to share those sort of similar experiences with people has just been absolutely joyous. And I hope we do come back in some form, even if it's not Beatle-related. But even if we don't, thanks very much for everyone to listening, and do keep beetling on.
Yeah, thank you so much. Keep beetling on.
Happy Christmas.
Thanks a lot, folks, and a happy Christmas and a merry new year.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.